How confident are you in this economy? We'll look at the state of housing, small business, and jobs. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Baltimore, I'm Amy Scott, in for Kai Rizdahl. It's Wednesday, March 29th. Good to have you with us. It is spring, the time of year when daffodils and for sale signs typically start popping up in front yards, traditionally anyway. And after a long winter for housing, there have been some signs of a thaw. We learned today from the National Association of Realtors that pending sales of existing homes picked up in February for the third straight month. Those are homes under contract that will show up as official sales in the coming months. And this follows last week's news that sales completed in February rose for the first time in a year. Marketplace's Sabree Benishor has the story.
The housing market has been in the dumps these past 6 months or so. Compared to February a year ago, pending home sales were down 21%. Carl Tannenbaum is chief economist at Northern Trust.
We've had much higher interest rates, and because we've had a depletion in some quarters of pandemic-related saving, money for down payments is not as readily available as it once was.
But that said, compared to the month before, pending home sales crept up in February, 0.8%, third positive month in a row. Now, pending home sales are not done deals. They're just pending, meaning the paperwork started, but the actual closing probably won't happen for a month or two. So more housing paperwork in February is actually a sign of something that happened a month or two earlier. Nadia Evangelou is senior economist for the National Association of Realtors.
The main reason for that was because of the lower mortgage rates that we had during December and January.
Mortgage rates actually dipped between January and early February from 6.5% to 6.1%. And that was enough for tens of thousands of homebuyers to pounce. The fact that so many homebuyers lunged at the opportunity is a sign of how stressed they are, says Danielle Hale, chief economist at Realtor.com.
A lot of home shoppers are at the edge of their budget range. And when mortgage rates come down, that creates a little more breathing room.
But of course, mortgage rates didn't stay down. They ticked back up in February and then started to tick back down this month. A bumpy ride for mortgage rates means a bumpy ride for home sales. Igor Popov is chief economist at Apartment List.
If mortgage rates rise from here, then home sales will really continue to be very slow and housing activity will be slow. But if mortgage rates continue to fall, then, you know, we might see that a lot of these potential buyers that have been on the sidelines start to get out there and buy homes.
And what'll happen to mortgage rates has a lot to do with what the Fed does with interest rates, which is a big TBD. Surveys from the New York Fed show Americans expect mortgages to hit about 8% a year from now. In New York, I'm Sabree Benishor for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, it was green across the board. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. If you missed the show yesterday, Kai had a really interesting conversation with Catherine Rampell of The Washington Post about why Americans seem to feel so lousy about an economy that by many measures is still going strong. Today, a follow-up of sorts, a new survey of small businesses from the U.S. Chamber of Commerce and insurer MetLife shows a similar disconnect. Just one in five small business owners said they feel good about the health of the economy right now, down from the previous quarter, even though a majority of them said their own business is doing well. Marketplace's Samantha Fields has more.
When I asked Fiore Tedesco III how he feels about the economy right now, as a chef and restaurant owner at Locadoro in Austin, he started out sounding optimistic.
My first instinct is to say, I feel fine about it because people are coming into the restaurant. We are busy. But
you knew there was going to be a but.
A big part of that economy is, what does it cost to live in this country, in this world? And the cost of labor, because of the cost of living and the cost of goods, has gone up so much, it's hard to keep up. So
just 40 seconds later, his optimism was gone.
I would say as an overall, I don't feel great about it. I feel like it's not a sustainable economy.
Not sustainable because all of his costs are rising, food, labor.
And I'm scared to raise prices.
Because he wants to stay busy. He doesn't want to risk driving guests away. But he can't just keep absorbing all the rising costs either. A lot of business owners are feeling some version of this, says Tom Sullivan at the U.S. Chamber of Commerce.
We have seen five straight quarters where inflation is the highest concern by small business.
One of the ways that's bearing out?
There was a sharp drop in planned investments by small business.
Many are putting off buying new equipment or renovating storefronts and other things like that. That's true for Emily Glockler, who owns a small store and event space in Chicago called One Strange Bird. Her business is doing well, but rising interest rates and the banking crisis and high-profile layoffs have her nervous.
I would love to open up another shop, but it's always just one of those scary risks to take, especially when you're viewing the lending rates and whether you're going to use personal finances or take a loan.
So she's holding off for now and figuring she'll see where the economy is in a year or so. I'm Samantha Fields for Marketplace.
I really hate to do this, but let me take you back for a moment to the spring of 2020, when most American schools went virtual. That was, of course, just one of so many challenges that arrived with COVID-19. But the sudden shift to remote learning was not easy for teachers, students, or their parents. As a result, some families decided to just do the teaching themselves. New research from Stanford University and the Associated Press says homeschool enrollment increased by 30% in the first 2 years of the pandemic. Now many states are allowing families to use public funds to cover some of the costs of a home education. Marketplace's Stephanie Hughes reports.
In the Fulbright household in Columbia, Maryland, the dining area doubles as a classroom. Bright light comes through the windows as Anna Fulbright gets her kids' geography lesson underway.
Look at this. This is the Gulf of Mexico, and then we have the Persian Gulf right here. So what do you kind of notice about them?
One of them looks like a jellyfish, kind of.
Harry's six, his sister Natalie's 10. Fulbright then pulls out Play-Doh to let them make their own geographical features.
You have the ocean and a lake?
Yeah.
Wow.
The kids had been in the local public school, but Natalie has Down syndrome, which affects her fine motor skills. And when her school went totally virtual, it was hard for her to use the online tools, like a digital abacus.
He really was not happy with it.
So in fall 2020, Fulbright started teaching the kids herself. She's a scientist who used to work for a biotech company. She's been a full-time parent since her oldest son was born. Members of her church were homeschooling already, so she had some support.
I'm not naturally a patient person. I never would have considered teaching elementary school as a career, for sure. But, you know, I love my children, and I want them to learn and make it a positive experience, so I have to just remember that.
In Maryland, 8 subjects are mandatory for homeschoolers. Ones you'd expect, like English, math, phys ed. Twice a year, Fulbright meets with a local official to show samples of the kids' work. But she's not required to submit grades or curriculum. The one she uses is faith-based and includes lessons in Latin and philosophy as the kids get older. Today, her eldest child, 12-year-old Logan, is spending the day at a homeschool co-op, which uses a program from a company called Classical Conversations. The kids go once a week to see other students and learn from other homeschooling parents.
Okay, so we're going to take 15, hopefully that's all it'll take, minutes or so to draw.
It's bustling. There are about 60 kids here today in small classes. One of the co-op's directors and a homeschooling parent herself is Leanne McNamee. She says this co-op has grown from 18 students to more than 100 since it started nearly a decade ago.
Because it's not weird anymore. Yeah, it's right. So when I started, it was like homeschool. Like, who's that, you know?
There's actually not a lot of data about who, says Stanford education professor Thomas Dee. He's author of the research on the recent increase.
We know far too little about the homeschooling that many families took up during the pandemic.
That said, at least 12 states now have laws in place that provide funding for home education expenses. The amounts differ, up to $9,000 annually. That's according to Emily Ronco at the National Conference of State Legislatures, who says the legislation usually details what's considered an eligible expense and what's not.
Today, I looked through several of these bills, and at least two of them specifically mention that, like, a home theater is not considered an eligible expense.
Permissible expenses vary, but usually include curriculum and tuition. Maryland does not allocate public money for homeschooling. Anna Fulbright says she spent about $3,700 on it this school year. That includes books and the faith-based co-op, which costs around $565 for each of the younger kids and $1,500 for her older son. Co-op director Leanne McNamee says she'd be wary of public money, even if it was an option.
We believe that the minute you start taking government money, then eventually they're going to start telling you what to do.
Independence is a big theme at the co-op. This morning, 12-year-old Logan Fulbright's class has asked to work on cartography. The kids are drawing a map of Northern Africa, freehand. Logan says he also does a lot of work independently.
So, like, later today, I'm going to plan out my week, and I get to choose how much of what I do each day.
Homeschooling seems to be working for the Fulbright family, but we don't know much about families where it's not. Again, Stanford's Thomas D.
Because they're outside every sort of normal system. And that exact question is one we'll have to struggle with. What is society's responsibility to monitor the well-being and development of these children?
Especially as society provides more money to fund those children's lessons at home. I'm Stephanie Hughes for Marketplace.
Coming up.
That overnight shift turned out to be a magical solution for him.
Working tough hours can pay off. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Jones Industrial Average rose 323 points, 1% even, to finish at 32,717. The NASDAQ picked up 210 points, 1.8% to close at 11,926, and the S&P 500 added 56 points, 1.4% to end at 4027. The FDA has approved over-the-counter sales of Narcan, the drug that can reverse opioid overdoses. Drug maker Emergent BioSolutions hasn't said what it'll charge for a dose. Shares picked up just over 5%. Activist investor Carl Icahn has been waging a battle for control of biotech firm Illumina. Today, he told the Wall Street Journal he wants the company's chairman and former CEO to resume running the company. Shares added 3.8%. Lululemon Athletica sees a rosy 2023 ahead. The athleisure wear marketer said it's working through an inventory glut and seeing strong sales. Shares jumped almost 12.75%. You're listening to Marketplace.
With access to so much information, it's hard to feel like an informed, discerning citizen. That's why on Make Me Smart, which is a podcast from Marketplace, we make it easy for you to stay in the know. Hi, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I unpack the latest from Washington, D.C.
The Senate Minority Leader has announced that he will step down as the Republican leader.
What's happening in AI? I mean, don't buy at the top, but holy cow, artificial intelligence and all the companies related to it are the hot new thing. And we do the numbers.
So as a refresher, inflation is the rate of increase in the prices of things. It's not just sort of things getting more expensive. It's the speed at which things get more expensive.
Because in a world that's constantly changing, we all need to stay smart. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Marketplace. I'm Amy Scott. We talked earlier about homeschooling. For many kids who attend public schools, school isn't just where they learn and make friends and play sports. It's also where they get a lot of their nutrition. Earlier in the pandemic, lots of school districts started offering free meals to all of their students, not just those from low-income families who qualified for subsidies. That was thanks to federal waivers that allowed those districts to get reimbursed. That program expired in September. September. But a handful of states, including California and Maine, have made their pandemic-era policies permanent. And now the USDA is looking to help more school districts cover the costs of universal free meals. Marketplace's Savannah Marr has more.
The USDA's community eligibility provision helps out school districts where at least 40% of students benefit from SNAP. That puts universal free meals just out of reach for the Greeley Evans School District in northern Colorado.
34% of our students are living in households receiving SNAP benefits.
But Danielle Bach, the district's director of nutrition, says over 60% are eligible for free or reduced-priced meals. So her staff spend a lot of time processing individual applications for assistance.
We have to be able to identify if this particular student in this particular school in this particular line is eligible to receive that free meal.
The USDA's proposal to lower the threshold to 25% of students on SNAP would reduce that administrative burden.
It allows us to focus more on the quality of the meal.
Universal free meals kept a lot of kids from going hungry at the height of the pandemic, says education researcher Emily Gutierrez at the Urban Institute.
Particularly in a time where inflation is at an all-time high, it's something that a lot of students have gotten used to or families have gotten used to.
But even some eligible districts opt out of offering free meals because federal reimbursements for those meals are only partial. Crystal Fitzsimmons at the Food Research and Action Center says President Biden's proposed budget would help more schools take advantage.
It would dramatically increase the amount of funding that these high-need schools are receiving and make it much more financially viable.
For Danielle Bach in the Greeley Evans School District, one benefit of pandemic-era free meals stands out.
We identified an immediate relief from that shame and that stigma that is associated with being a quote-unquote free lunch kid.
Or from racking up lunch debt. If her district becomes eligible for the USDA's expanded free lunch program, Bach says that's another thing her staff won't have to deal with anymore. I'm Savannah Marr for Marketplace.
We will get a fresh look at how employment is holding up next Friday when the jobs report for March comes out. Even as more companies have announced big layoffs, think Amazon, Disney, Facebook, overall unemployment has stayed low, even though the Federal Reserve has been trying very hard to cool off the labor market in its effort to bring down inflation. But a new book challenges that trade-off by looking at the bigger picture. Catherine Newman and Elizabeth Jacobs just published Moving the Needle, What Tight Labor Markets Do for the Poor. They joined me to talk about the book, which Catherine says they started researching before the pandemic when unemployment reached a 50-year low.
Employment plays such a critical role in every single theory of poverty. Bad employment prospects, low earnings, erratic take-home pay is a generative aspect of poverty. So what happens when that's not the case anymore? And that's why we wrote the book.
And of course, after 2019, unemployment spiked sharply at the start of the pandemic. But now we're back in what you can call a very tight labor market with unemployment at 3.6%. What did you find? How does a tight labor market benefit the very poor?
The first thing that happens is that employers begin to seek people who they didn't consider eligible for employment before. They pull in people like young Black men, who usually are at the very back of the queue in desirable employees in a loose labor market. They began to think about people coming out of the prison system. They consider single mothers to a much greater degree. Then they try to improve the quality of the jobs they have because they can't hold on to people if they don't. They raise wages, they increase benefits. So the whole labor market shifts in very surprising and important ways. And it has an enormous benefit, especially to the people at the bottom.
This is Elizabeth. I can just jump in to add that we were able to trace people across tight labor markets over time. And what we found is that when unemployment goes below about 4.5%, folks who've been out of work find work and keep work, which I think is a really important thing to think about, because part of what happens when folks cycle in and out of the labor market, they aren't able to actually get a foothold and start that climb up the middle class and out of poverty. The other thing that I'll say is that we've seen that in times that don't necessarily come with the kind of hand-waving over inflation, which we've talked about many times over because the book has kind of arrived into a labor market where unemployment is still quite low, but prices have risen quite a bit. And one of the things that we see is that those two things aren't necessarily related.
Yeah, and we'll talk about inflation a little bit later on, but I wanted to get to an example in the book of how this benefits someone who would traditionally be on the fringes of the labor market. Tell me about Sam in Boston.
So Sam had a very, very rough childhood. He was arrested in a very serious way when he was 18. And for the next 20 years, he was a guest of the Massachusetts criminal justice system.
A guest.
He has a very rocky history, violence, drug abuse. But when his sentence was up, he graduated into that very tight labor market that spawned this book in the first place. He had a full-time job within about 2 weeks of leaving prison. And it was an overnight job, stocking shelves for a grocery store near where his family lived.
And just to jump in here for a moment, he targeted an overnight job.
Yes.
Because he had advice, right, that those are less competitive positions and someone coming in with a criminal record is more likely to get such a job.
Not necessarily in a loose labor market, but in a tight labor market, the combination of undesirable qualities of the job, mainly that it's all night long, and the fact that employers have a hard time finding people in general for night shifts. But when labor markets are very tight, they can't find a single soul. And that overnight shift turned out to be a magical solution for him because he graduated into management, graduated into better shifts. Ultimately, he left that job behind and went on into even better jobs. The idea that someone with a background like Sam's could make that happen is, I think, testimony to the way in which tight labor markets shift the prospects for the hard to employ and push employers to look in corners they didn't look in before.
Elizabeth, what happens to people like Sam, though, when the economy shifts and unemployment starts to rise? Are they able to hold on to those gains in the labor market?
So folks who found opportunity in a tight labor market are more likely to hold on. At the same time, we do know that when the labor market collapses, those folks are often the first out the door. That said, your likelihood of reemployment and reemployment at a relatively solid wage is much higher if you've had the opportunity during a tight labor market to work and earn and generate a track record as someone who is really deeply connected and valuable in the labor market.
You talk in the book about the Fed's dual mandate, full employment and stable prices. And recently the approach has been, you know, to sacrifice some employment to try to bring down inflation. And, you know, while there would be job losses associated with that likely, we know that inflation also hits the poor the hardest. Do you think the Fed is making the right trade-off?
We have both spent a lot of time talking with people and looking very closely at the numbers that track people's lives over time. And it's very clear that inflation and opportunity for workers don't need to be trade-offs. I mean, I think the dialogue around what to do about rising prices right now has focused so narrowly on this idea that we have to push unemployment up in order to control prices. And there are many, many other reasons that inflation may be going up that go outside of pitting those two against each other and having the narrative turn into a trade-off between price stability and opportunity for workers, particularly those at the bottom.
You lay out some policies in the book that could help people who get on that ladder during a period of tight labor market stay there. You know, how would you summarize kind of the best approach? Because a reality of our economy is that we have business cycles. There are going to be periods of high unemployment and periods of low unemployment. What do we do to help people once the market shifts?
If you reward employers through the tax system for investing in the human capital of their workers, those workers become more valuable, and that's probably the best training system we've got. raising the minimum wage has been a very important vehicle for stabilizing the whole wage structure at the bottom. The child allowance took one third of the nation's poor children out of poverty. We do know how to do this. We just need the political will to recognize that those stabilizing forces enable people at the bottom to manage through difficult periods and prosper during the best periods and hopefully see their way right up out of the poverty category altogether.
Catherine Newman and Elizabeth Jacobs are co-authors of Moving the Needle, What Tight Labor Markets Do for the Poor. Thank you both so much.
Thanks, Amy.
Thank you, Amy.
This final note on the way out today, slow down, folks. That's the message of an open letter signed by more than 1,000 tech leaders, researchers, and concerned citizens calling for a pause in the development of advanced artificial intelligence systems. The signers include Elon Musk, who co-founded the research lab OpenAI, maker of ChatGPT. Also, Steve Wozniak, co-founder of Apple, former presidential candidate Andrew Yang, and many other big names in tech. The letter follows OpenAI's release this month of more advanced technology it calls GPT-4. Musk and the others call on all AI labs to take 6 months off before they attempt anything more powerful and say if that doesn't happen, governments should step in. To sum up the concerns, here's a quote from the letter. Recent months have seen AI labs locked in an out-of-control race to develop and deploy ever more powerful digital minds that no one, not even their creators, can understand, predict, or reliably control. Here's your moment of economic context. As members of the U.S. House took their turn today grilling top banking regulators over the failure of SVB, the White House is expected to call for stricter rules for mid-sized banks. According to the Washington Post, the new rules would target banks with between $100 and $250 billion in assets. Oversight of these smaller banks was relaxed during the Trump administration. Our media production team includes Brian Allison, Jake Cherry, Drew Jostad, Gary O'Keefe, Jeff Peters, Charlton Thorpe, Juan Carlos Torrado, and Becca Weinman. I'm Amy Scott. We'll be back tomorrow. This is APM.
With access to so much information, it's hard to feel like an informed, discerning citizen. That's why on Make Me Smart, which is a podcast from Marketplace, we make it easy for you to stay in the know. Hi, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I unpack the latest from Washington, D.C.
The Senate Minority Leader has announced that he will step down as the Republican leader.
What's happening in AI? Don't buy at the top, but holy cow, artificial intelligence and all the companies related to it are the hot new thing. And we do the numbers.
So as a refresher, inflation is the rate of increase in the prices of things. It's not just sort of things getting more expensive. It's the speed at which things get more expensive.
Because in a world that's constantly changing, we all need to stay smart. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts.